You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Google dolls all the time. Think Joe Biden's going to be able to fight off everybody, to include himself? Painful to watch, man. You're not supposed to talk over the music. That's a DJ rule for all you aspiring DJs out there. Here it comes. Alright, so you're going to listen to BBC now. Alright, so what you're going to hear next coming up here is what other people are saying about this whole issue. Right, so you can have your opinion, I can have my opinion, but pretty important issue. And our conflict with Iran goes back decades, right? 40 years. And Iran has raised to an art form, putting the United States in situations where the United States doesn't want to escalate the situation. So in order to de-escalate, right, we do stuff that we're probably not comfortable with. I would tell you a lot of people would say that. Yeah, I didn't like it. Not comfortable with it. So where does this all go? And as I said before, looming in the background of all of this is Israel. So this is from yesterday from the Sky News Hour, and you're going to hear them talking about they're talking about United States, Iran, and then the president actually makes an announcement in the middle of what they're doing. They stop for it. I'll skip that, and then we'll hear the end of it. And then you'll hear a second BBC piece from, right? You'll hear a second piece in the BBC that deals with the confrontation between Iran and the United States. So here you have it. What other nations say.
Where do we begin?
Where do we begin? We begin by jumping into a stream.
Good evening. We start the news hour with some breaking news. And President Trump has imposed tough new sanctions on Iran, specifically targeted at the country's supreme leader in response to the shooting down of an American drone. Mr. Trump says the United States does not want conflict, but Iran will not be allowed to get nuclear weapons. Our correspondent, Amanda Walker, joins me from Washington. So, Amanda, he pulled back at the last moment from military action, but new sanctions announced now.
New sanctions, they flirted with military action, didn't they? And they seem now confident that economic punishment is the way forward with Iran. So this is just coming into us, Mark, as we speak. He has confirmed that he's signing an executive order imposing hard-hitting sanctions on Iran, going straight to the top, saying that the order will deny the supreme leader and others access to financial instruments. Donald Trump says, we will continue to increase pressure on Tehran. Never can Iran have a nuclear weapon, which ultimately is what these sanctions are all about. Now, in the run-up to getting ready for that military strike. Apparently, Donald Trump was told by his Secretary of State that the maximum pressure campaign, which is really these sanctions, is having the desired effect. Some analysts say that Iran's oil revenue is down 2/3. So I think he certainly feels bolstered by that, and that's why they're continuing with this. He says that the new executive order on sanctions...
Pretty amazing, right? If their oil revenue is down 2/3, that's a stunning hit, right, for their economy to absorb.
Was going to happen regardless of the drone shoot down, and of course the deal maker in chief also adding that he would love to get a deal with Iran. He says, I think a lot of restraint has been shown by us, but that doesn't mean we're going to show it in the future. And that echoes what he said in an interview over the weekend. He said, we don't want to go to war, but if we did, it would be obliteration. It's a possibility. He likes to use that as a threat, really, while saying economic sanctions are the way we think is basically the best way to get Iran to start complying, to start showing that it's going to back down. But so far, maximum pressure is only being met with maximum defiance and resistance, as we can see those continued acts that the Trump administration say is pure provocation, whether it's the oil tankers, the shooting down of the drone. So far, it's hard to see how this campaign is working, other than the fact that the economy in Iran is really struggling.
Yeah, okay. Amanda, just stay there a second. I think we can hear now from President Trump about these sanctions.
Okay. So what they do is they roll the videotape of the president in the Oval Office, but because we've already heard that, we will go ahead and skip to the place where they pick this back up. Stand by, and here we go.
Signing that order for tough new sanctions on Iran. Amanda Walker is still with us in Washington. Amanda, interesting to see how Europe reacts to this. And also interesting that he says there he still wants talks and he doesn't want conflict. Is it significant that he's targeting personally the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei?
Has had his calls for talks rejected by the leader. So is this a response to that? But it's interesting the sort of language that Trump is using there, suggesting that Iran could have a great future. He's trying a bit of his flattery that he has done with North Korea, suggesting that he could be the person to take things into a completely new era when it comes to U.S. relations. And that really appeals to Donald Trump, the idea that he could have a breakthrough on these issues that have plagued the U.S. for decades, whether it's North Korea, Iran, that he could be the one to see a new dawn in those relations. He talked about showing restraint, which certainly some people here, analysts, have been saying, you know, we criticize Donald Trump a lot, but in pulling back at the 11th hour, he did show restraint that the next day the US and the world was in a much better position than it would have been if he had pressed go. And that's also adding that they may not show that restraint in the future. So he's trying to keep his powder dry. They are confident that Iran is being punished by these sanctions, that is the way to continue if they want Iran to eventually sort of go the way and comply and keep going on that path, which is all about, they say, them not having a nuclear weapon, which is, of course, what that Obama-Iran deal was all about. But it was one of the first things when he came into office that Donald Trump wanted to dismantle. He says it was a terrible deal, and he wants to get his own deal.
Okay, Amanda.
So that's Amanda. And that's Sky News and BBC. All right, next one is a little bit more focused on American policy. This is from the BBC World News Today, I believe from Sunday.
Let's return to our top story now. President Trump calling off an attack on Iran with just 10 minutes to spare. Joining me now from Singapore is Ben Talablu, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us here on BBC News. What's your analysis of events over the past 24 hours or so? Do you think that the US and Iran are moving closer towards an armed conflict or moving away from it?
Even if the events of the past 24 hours hadn't happened, when you have two adversaries operating in such close geographic proximity with sustained hostilities for such a protracted period of time, then it's obvious that even unintended escalation could be a byproduct of that geographic proximity and political hostility. But when you look at why this most recent action mattered and why so many were so rightly worried, it was because Iran, which has a penchant for proxy warfare and asymmetric attacks, directly took on a U.S. aircraft and essentially shot this drone out of the sky and was proud of it and touted it, and the U.S. military seconded that Iran has actually taken down this drone. So it meant that this country, which was traditionally not escalating in this fashion, was more willing to take risks. And when you overlay the Max Pressure campaign against this narrative, and you overlay the history of the U.S.-Iran enmity, then one can rightly see how this could spiral out of control.
I just want to interject in here. This guy's a pretty well thought out guy, and has some interesting things to say. The point that the previous War on the Rocks made, right, in that article I read from there, that opinion piece, about there's certain things that the government of Iran does not control, and the proxy wars waged by the IRGC are not controlled by, quote-unquote, the federal government. The nuclear program is, for now. So it's really interesting when you heard the president say, right, this may be somebody who wasn't operating on instructions. What the president, I believe, is trying to do is exploit a reality in Iranian life of the IRGC operates independent of the federal government. And so you'll hear that theme, right? You'll hear that theme in that the wars tend to be by proxy, and all of a sudden there's this specific confrontation with the United States. So to me it's interesting the way people discuss that. So he continues.
It's driven by Iranian escalation.
Why does Iran want to take these risks, in your view, given that they could never win a conventional war against the United States?
That's an excellent question. The reason Iran is trying to escalate, not just in the skies or in the Persian Gulf or in some countries where its proxies are active, such as Iraq or Syria, but even its nuclear program, it's gradually pushing the caps imposed on its nuclear program by the JCPOA nuclear deal, is because it's looking to develop this political warfare strategy against the Trump administration's economic sanctions. The economic sanctions that the Trump administration resurrected have been in place for more than a year now, and Tehran is trying to dull those sanctions, get the administration to slow the pace of the new sanctions, to water down the existing sanctions, and to cease the enforcement of the present sanctions. Ultimately, this is designed to drive America to publicly covet a deal and have Trump water down U.S. positions, water down U.S. red lines, and make America in the position that it was in 2013 when Obama over-eagerly engaged with Tehran and issued concessions to them at the negotiating table and led to the flawed interim and final nuclear deals. So this is Tehran's way of generating leverage, instilling fear, and trying to stop the sanctions from being so successful.
Well, given that Donald Trump...
How about that? So we talked about the made-for-TV event, right? So we're going to ratchet up the heat. We're going to talk about going to war, right, even though everybody knows we won't, unless the Americans decide to, okay? And we're going to create this drama in order to have something to solve. And the solution will involve American concessions.
Has in the past few hours increased economic sanctions. If that is their strategy, it's not working now. Can you see that it will ever work?
Iran has only very few times in its history upended completely its national security goals or national security strategy. And those were times when it was presented with the regime collapsing or coming to the brink or some sort of precipice, such as ending the Iran-Iraq War. That's the classic example in 1988. I do think sanctions can force the regime's hand, but I think that it's going to take more than just sanctions to tamp down on this broad array of malign activities, again, be it in the Gulf, in Iraq, Syria, or even in the skies. I think Tehran is looking to use escalation in all these theaters as leverage and instill fear in the administration and make the administration, in fact, look bad, as some could say was the case when it does back down.
Okay, Ben Talablu from Singapore, thank you very much for your analysis. Let's return to our...
Interesting, right? Yeah, I like that guy. All right, pretty clear-headed, I would say, for somebody... pretty clear-headed for somebody who wants to, you know, who, from outside the United States. But this whole, I just, again, I find it interesting, this whole duality of policies or of areas of responsibility inside of Iran. Who drives what? All right. Now, this, I will tell you, this next piece is from Al Jazeera. And you're going to find stuff in here that is just absolutely maddening. But, right, it plays in a lot of the world. Okay? So we've gone from Trump wants to rescue this and be seen as this person that can make a deal where others can't. And that's what he wants from Iran. That's what he wants from North Korea. So that was in the first BBC piece. Second BBC piece was... Hey, Iran, and to me it's one of the most clear-eyed, you know, because we talked about the made-for-TV event. Why? Well, they want relief. So what they'll do is they'll take this thing up to the brink, and then the solution will be some type of watering down of the sanctions. That's what the solution will be. So that's the reason for, you know, all the different events that have led up to this, the announcement of violating the JPOA and all of that. Okay, so now this is from Al Jazeera, and you know, again, it's the reason you listen is to learn what people are saying. So here's what's being said on Al Jazeera when they roundtable this stuff. Here's a commercial.
Do you care about your car? Then check this out.
Yeah, check it out. Whoa.
Yeah, that slides right off. That is because we are using a hybrid wax sealant spray.
You should buy. We should all buy that.
Will the U.S. attack Iran? There is intense debate in Washington following the downing of a U.S. drone. Donald Trump accuses Tehran of making a big mistake. Iran says the U.S. violated its sovereignty. So what does this mean for an already tense region? This is Inside Story.
Yeah, Inside Story on Al Jazeera, and that's what you're going to listen to right now.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Peter Dobby. A tense standoff between the U.S. and Iran following the downing of an American surveillance drone in the Strait of Hormuz. Iranian state TV has been showing what it says is drone wreckage retrieved at sea. The American media says President Trump ordered airstrikes against military targets in Iran, but then, later, changed his mind. Once again, he lashed out at his predecessor, Barack Obama, saying he made a desperate and terrible deal with Iran. Donald Trump said he'd stopped the strike against Iran. Earlier, congressional leaders were briefed on the incident and called for a robust response, but they also told the president to act with caution.
The high tension wires are up in the region for a lot of different reasons.
Nancy Pelosi.
Some bilateral in the region, some multilateral, some religious, whatever it is. The high tension wires are up. And third, we must act in a way that does not that does de-escalate and does not escalate the tensions and the situation there.
The president may not intend to go to war here, but we're worried that he and the administration may bumble into a war.
Chuck Schumer, right there. Lindsey Graham next.
We've been flying patterns like this for months. We're trying to collect intelligence to make informed decisions. We had told the Iranians before they shot the drone down that if you engage against American personnel or assets, you do so at your own peril. The president does not want a war with Iran or anybody else, but he is the commander-in-chief.
Well, speaking to the press during a meeting with the Canadian Prime Minister, President Trump called the downing of the drone, quote, a very big mistake.
I have a feeling I may be wrong.
Okay, now remember, the duality that exists inside of Iran, the IRGC, running the proxy wars, the federal government running the nuclear program.
And I may be right, but I'm right a lot. I have a feeling that it was a mistake made by somebody that shouldn't have been doing what they did. I think they made a mistake. And I'm not just talking about the country made a mistake. I think that somebody under the command of that country made a big mistake.
The U.S. maintains it was flying in international airspace, but Iran disputes where the incident took place. During a televised speech, the head of the Revolutionary Guard reiterated his position.
Now, why is the head of the Revolutionary Guard speaking? Right? Can you imagine the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? I'm going to tell you something. Yeah. Why? And again, I'm late to the party relative to understanding Iran, but so he's bloviating here in his uniform with a flag behind him.
It's a clear and concise message. The defenders of the borders of the Islamic Iranian nation respond to all foreign aggression, and our reaction is, and will be, categorical and absolute. The borders represent a red line.
Okay, let's get going. Let's bring in our guests today. They are Mohammed Marandi. He's head of American Studies at the University of Tehran. He joins us from the Iranian capital. Hilary Manley.
That guy. Listen to the shit he says. Now, the woman also says some crazy shit, but she's an American.
Leverett is CEO of the political risk consultancy group Strategia and formerly a U.S. State Department official. She joins us from Washington. And keeping us company in London, Sahil Shah. He's a policy fellow at the European Leadership Network, where he leads the Iran Project, which works to protect the Iranian nuclear agreement. Welcome to you all. Mohammed Marandi in Tehran, welcome back to Inside Story. As far as the Trump administration is concerned, is there, as of today, a plan B when it comes to what do we do next?
Oh, hold on. There's a commercial in here. Oh. Stand by.
I think that's probably the most important problem that the team in Washington has created for Trump. There is no exit strategy. This maximum pressure policy that the United States has imposed on Iran.
So this is Mohammed Marandi, head of American Studies, University of Tehran. So he's a professor at Tehran University and an Iranian political analyst. So again, this is the guy who's going to send your blood pressure through the roof, period.
Is really a dead end. The Iranians are saying that we've, after 10 years of negotiations, agreed to a nuclear deal. We've given significant concessions. We've been flexible. And now the United States has exited the deal. It is forcing other countries not to abide by their commitments, including other countries who were at the negotiating table. And it is demanding that Iran give new concessions. And the Iranians know that this is a slippery slope that will lead to disaster. If Iran appeases the United States, then in future, every time the United States wants something more, they will impose sanctions again. So the Iranians are saying, we will not appease the United States. If the United States wants to talk about even other issues than the nuclear program, they have to show that they are reliable partners, that they can commit themselves to previous agreements, and that they will implement them. If those were implemented, then perhaps the Iranians and Americans would be able to talk about other issues. But the Americans have gone down a very different road. And because of that, not only can the Iranians not renegotiate the nuclear deal, that is impossible, but they cannot negotiate with the Americans on any other issue because the Americans are unreliable. So Trump is now standing in a dead end. He can only escalate, which is dangerous, or he has to retreat, which is something that I find it very difficult for someone like him to do.
Hilary Mann Leverett in Washington. Is there any chance?
Hilary Mann Leverett. Never heard of her.
Now that they can hold talks that are basically built on the idea of mutual interest?
I think potentially talks based on mutual interest. I have tremendous respect for my colleague in Tehran, Professor Mirandi, but I think the premise that any talks with the United States based on the United States proving that it's a reliable partner are not going to work. It's not just under the Trump administration that the United States is not reliable. The United States under multiple administrations has found itself, even though the president comes to office constantly demeaning and insulting Iran, they always come to realize and understand that they need to talk to Iran because of the strength of Iran in its region and in geopolitics and geoeconomics. Each administration comes to understand it needs to talk to Iran. And each administration does try to do so, but then in the end is not reliable, whether it was the Reagan administration over in Lebanon over U.S. hostages, whether it was the Clinton administration in Bosnia, whether it was the Bush administration where I served over Afghanistan, or even the Obama administration and now Trump. The United States is not reliable. The United States is looking at its interests as it sees it. And I think there are talks possible based on this idea of mutual interest and perhaps mutual respect. But the idea that the United States is going to be a reliable partner would defy, you know, 40 years of U.S.-Iranian interaction, particularly from the U.S. side. Where I see potential possibility here is that President Trump, unlike his predecessors, does see some value in having a deal with a strong Iran that benefits, as Trump sees it, the United States, U.S. interests, and U.S. companies. This is different than prior administrations. It's still not an ideal situation, I would think, from the Iranian perspective or even for other international partners. But it is the one difference that President Trump puts on the table that his predecessors have not.
Sahil Shah in London, who is the U.S. president listening to?
That's a very good question. I think that we could probably have a pretty mixed answer given the fact that we now know that he called for airstrikes but then recalled the order, given the fact that he felt the proportionality of the consequences, which he has told media would be about 150 deaths, wasn't...
All right, this guy's name is Sahil Shah. He's a policy fellow at the European Leadership Network. He's a nuclear arms researcher, and he's a non-proliferation consultant.
You know, equitable to the unmanned drone that Iran had shot down. I think the fact that the strikes were actually ordered shows that certain voices were winning at a point in the debate, but then because they were recalled, perhaps Trump's own intuition tempered that, or somebody else influenced him. We're not quite sure, but what we know in Europe is that it's become very difficult for Europeans to see how their voice can matter on the Hill and who their allies really are, due to the fact that it's not just Trump and his administration that aren't necessarily handling the Iran file very well, but also Democrats have been remarkably quiet until this recent escalation. And there are a number of ways in which Democrats could help de-escalate and help Europeans make sure that Iran sees some value in staying within the constraints of the deal and also not acting out in the region in a way that could bait the Trump administration's more hawkish voices into conflict.
Mohammed in Tehran, as far as the administration where you are is concerned, what are their suspicions as to second-guessing what Donald Trump's end game is here? I mean, you can't threaten conflict. It's counterintuitive. You can't threaten conflict and push people back to the negotiating table.
Well, the Iranians believe that it's the United States that's left the negotiating table. The United States was a part of the P5+1. And these negotiations had taken place for over a decade. So even Rex Tillerson, the U.S. Secretary of State, the first U.S. Secretary of State under Trump, he was at the negotiating table until Trump left. So that's one issue. The second issue is that the very fact that there's so much chaos in the White House, and we really don't know what happened. We don't know if they seriously were about to carry out a strike. We don't know at all often what goes on in the White House. And everyone speaks of confusion there. And that's another reason why the Iranians simply cannot negotiate with the United States. They're both unreliable, and it's unclear what they're after. The president is constantly speaking in inconsistent ways, and his Secretary of State and other senior officials like Bolton, their language and their statements are inconsistent with what the president says. So the
So you have the Iranian dude, right? The teacher, the professor. He's, you know, he's saying that, that the United States can't be negotiated with and is an unreliable partner. You have the American on the panel saying that the United States can't be relied upon to negotiate with. Interesting, eh?
Iranians basically cannot count on anything that comes out of Washington. What's important for Iran is that the United States is waging war on Iran. This is an economic war. Trump has admitted that. And he says it's a brutal, these are brutal sanctions. So he's brutalizing the Iranian population. He's attacking Iranian women and children on a daily basis, basically. And the Iranians are saying that the United States has escalated the situation through not only violating the nuclear deal, but trying to harm ordinary Iranians as much as possible, in constantly threatening Iran. We have to remember that Trump just recently spoke about destroying Iran, constantly speaking about all options are on the table, surrounding himself with people who are constantly speaking about war. So the Iranians, they are the only side that right now are abiding by the nuclear deal. For the last year, the Americans left. The Europeans have not been abiding by any part of the nuclear deal. They're in complete violation because they're fearful of Trump. And so the Iranians are saying, why should we continue to abide by a nuclear deal, whereas the other side is doing absolutely nothing? So the Iranians are in a difficult situation. They believe that they're the ones who are trying to de-escalate the situation. That's why they've remained in the deal. But on the other hand, we see that the Europeans are constantly telling the Iranians not to raise tensions, whereas it's the other side that is raising tensions, and the Europeans are cooperating with the Americans to a very large degree.
Okay, Mohammed, let me just pause you there for a second, because if what we're talking about here is mixed messages from the Trump White House, maybe some of those mixed messages come from John Bolton, President Trump's security advisor. He has long argued for using force against Iran. Now, he's been dismissive of international diplomacy, and he's advocated the use of military action. He did criticize the 2015 nuclear deal, saying, quote, only bombing by the U.S. and Israel would take out Iran's uranium enrichment installations, quotes. Now, he supports the MEK, that's an Iranian opposition group in exile, formerly listed by the U.S. as a terror organization. John Bolton has repeatedly told the group regime change is needed in Tehran. Mr. Bolton has adopted a tough approach to Iran throughout his professional life. For decades, he's promised consecutive Iranian administrations, the U.S. would, quotes, come after them. Hillary in Washington, has anything we've seen up to now breached the threshold of response? Because there seems to be a trickle down, which is this was an unmanned drone. Mr. Trump today talking about that on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Had it been a manned aircraft, maybe we would be having a completely different conversation now.
Well, I think what's potentially interesting and important to see through what is a very dangerous, very serious and very dangerous situation is that while on one hand there is chaos in some sense in the White House and in the team here, there is an intentionality to it that I think is really important to see and to understand. President Trump, since the 2016 campaign, has focused on basically two things vis-a-vis Iran. Iran's strength. He understands Iran's strength, and either he wants to deal with it, where Iran is basically working with the United States as Trump sees it in U.S. interests, or he is looking to fundamentally weaken Iran. They are two, in some ways, two diametrically opposed goals. But for Trump, the idea that you can be in a negotiation with Iran is real. He's in a negotiation, in a sense, with North Korea, something that John Bolton had also opposed previously. And in a sense, by Iran shooting down this unmanned U.S. drone, which is a large and expensive asset for the United States, it gives Iran some leverage in dealing with the Trump administration. And my assessment is that Trump is trying to put that out there to Iran, that you've downed this really important, expensive asset of the United States, and Trump has pulled back. this is an opportunity for Iran with some having the United States pulled back, having the United States, in a sense, stepped down for Iran to negotiate or at least talk with the United States. Not because Iran's going to necessarily get that much from the United States, but it can constrain the United States so Iran can build its relationship with others and to continue to build its own posture in the region.
Sahil in London, is part of the dynamic here as far as Mr. Trump kind of backing himself into a corner or being backed into a corner, if you will, the way that it would appear, certainly according to Mohammed in Tehran, that he has zero traction now with the Europeans because they privately and publicly are still on board when it comes to the JCPOA, but they can't do anything more than that because Tehran and Washington are at loggerheads?
Well, I think that I'd like to agree with a colleague from Washington, which is that Iran may now be in a better place optics-wise to enter some kind of a negotiation. But I think that what we have to keep in mind is that their current limit is the text and the letter of the JCPOA. Those constraints are ones that they feel that they've unilaterally now had to abide by. And the things that are part of the framework that Trump wished were part of the JCPOA, namely ballistic missiles as well as regional behavior, those are things that Europeans have also frantically tried to have an add-on agreement to the JCPOA for in the past before Trump withdrew from the deal. I should correct myself, Trump did not withdraw from the deal. He violated the deal. And what we're seeing is a huge...
Now, here's the interesting part of he violated the deal. He violated a treaty that's never been ratified here in the United States. I don't think you can violate that. But again, we come back to, right, this kind of duality that we want to consider Iran's nuclear ambitions separate from their regional ambitions. Nuclear governed by the federal government, regional, right, defined by and prosecuted by the Revolutionary Guard. So again, you see this dual theme throughout, right? And that when you attempt to merge the two and say, no, we're talking about one nation, Iran. We're not going to split those up. It's all one thing. And you have people say, well, it's really not. Interesting.
Huge discrepancy where the U.S. is seen as an actor that can withdraw from international agreements and Iran is seen as violating it. And this goes to show how the international community is really needed here to step in and urge for restraint, but also highlight the fact that all of these escalations are occurring because of the U.S.'s withdrawal or violation from the JCPOA, and also it could be a result of those around Trump who are trying to bait him into a conflict. And for Europeans, this is extremely risky. It is an absolute gamble to think that this is what is needed to get both countries to feel comfortable being in a negotiation. But in fact, because both countries have now shown their muscle and the U.S. has shown restraint and an awareness that a war would probably break out and be very catastrophic for the Middle East, that we may have a very narrow window here now for diplomacy. And I think Europeans need to lead that effort because we need to fold this from being a U.S.-Iran conversation into something more multilateral. And I'm not just speaking about the participants in the JCPOA, but if we start to talk about those things that Trump wanted to speak about, like ballistic missiles, we really need to have a regional conversation on what constraints make sense for Iran in the context of what other countries are also willing to concede.
So a regional conversation, right? I mean, come on. Who thinks that's going to go anywhere? With Saudi Arabia in there, the Gulf states. I mean, that's the whole hate shit show. That's the underlying basis for all of this. It continues.
Hillary, 2 points. If that window for opportunity is closing, just interrupt you and stop and hold that thought for a second. If that window for opportunity is closing, picking up on that point from Sahil in London, saying it's got to be a multilateral approach, was the approach historically before Donald Trump more productive because it wasn't primarily a binary choice? It wasn't Washington versus Tehran. There were lots of other people in the mix, but those people are now not in the mix, and they're feeling threatened and perhaps more aggressive than they were even just 4 weeks ago or 6 months ago.
We've taken an ordinary OC bus and have converted it into the world's biggest taco truck.
No, they're not going to do that, are they?
There you have it, the second commercial. Stand by.
Well, the reality is that the other parties were ineffectual. The Europeans did not keep up their side of the deal with Iran. Not the Chinese didn't even keep up their side. Neither did the Russians. The reality is, and what Trump, I think...
Oh, what? We don't hear too much about all of that.
Lays bare to the world is that the United States, in a lot of ways, is still the superpower, the aggressive, belligerent superpower. And here, I think it's important to understand, again, two things. For Trump, he has complete disdain for the JCPOA, really not because of Iran, but because of the Europeans. He does not want to benefit European companies or Chinese companies in doing business with Iran. He's focused on Iran in either one of two ways, and they're diametrically opposed.
You know what? I mean, so you hear that and you're like, what? Let me just say this. I don't think the president, this is just me, I could be wrong. I don't think the president gives a shit about European business, okay? If he can have a stable relationship with Iran and Iran not completely attempting to undermine the Middle East.
Opposed, and they're really important to understand, to either have a great deal that he can show that he achieved in opposition to his predecessor, President Obama, that doesn't have to even deal with any specifics about missiles or anything else. It's just a deal that Trump can tout as his own. The diametrically, excuse me, opposed goal of Trump, which is also important to understand, is that if he can't get a bigger, better deal with Iran that he can tout as his own, then I think he is fundamentally looking to weaken, if not destroy, Iran. And I think he's willing to burn the Persian Gulf along with Iran. That will give him a good opportunity to focus on domestic, here in the United States, domestic oil and gas drilling and fracking, which he sees as really important for his reelection, for the United States to become an energy superpower, to have energy dominance on the international stage. So these are two very different goals, and if he can get a deal with Iran, that would be great for him. But if he can't, this idea that he's going to settle for some middle-of-the-road diffusing of tension, keeping the price of gasoline down, I don't think that's there. I think his other goal, though, the other side of the extreme, is also there, to fundamentally weaken, if not destroy, Iran and push up, propel the United States as an energy superpower that will be to the detriment of not just Iran, but traditionally important oil and gas producers like Qatar and Russia.
Okay. Mohammed, very, very briefly, please, Mohammed, because we are trotting toward...
That's framed in a completely right economic vein, right? That's how he sees it. He doesn't want Europe to benefit from an economic relationship. He wants the United States, and he's willing to fight Iran militarily in order to change the infrastructure. I would say this, if there was regime change in Iran, right, Iran's share of all of that would expand exponentially, right, multiples. Right, their business would expand, their oil production and revenue would expand, all that would expand.
What's the end of our half-hour discussion? Does this increase the chance of an escalation, if only as a miscalculation? What if it's a manned aircraft? What if there's another USS Vicence, July the 3rd, 1988, when...
Now listen to this shit that this guy says. Okay, so everybody take a deep breath, blow it out, say, think of birdies and clear skies, think of Christmas morning, be happy. All right, listen to this shit.
A U.S. naval ship misidentified a civilian aircraft.
Well, the Iranians don't believe that the U.S. misidentified that civilian aircraft, and they gave false information to the international community, and the Western media accepted that information until years later when it came out that they had lied.
And that is something that Iranians believe is happening today. The Iranians don't believe the American version of what happened with the drone. The Iranians have recovered pieces of the drone in their territorial waters, and they believe that the United States doesn't want...
No, they recovered pieces, right? They went into international waters, they recovered pieces, and then they went back to Iran. No, I mean, it's stunning to listen to this, right? And that's why, to me, the benefit of listening to these kind of things is you're like, wow.
...want the truth to come out. And the commanders of the Iranian armed forces actually said that there was an American spy plane with 35 Americans on board that entered Iranian airspace, but they, when the Iranians warned them to leave, they left. So the Iranians do not want to attack American soldiers. They just want to protect their sovereignty. And therefore, I think...
Did you hear that? So explain to me the Iranian presence all over the region. Explain to me Iranians constantly attacking Americans over the course of the years. Explain that to me. Now you're the defender of the fatherland? Right.
This shows that it's the Iranians, by staying within the JCPOA, by refraining from attacking manned aircraft, even though they were inside Iranian territorial waters, that Iran is behaving reasonably, but that the United States is not. And the big danger is, you're absolutely correct, if the United States goes down this road, then I think it would be a tragedy for the international community.
Okay.
The oil and gas installations in the Persian Gulf region will be destroyed, the tankers destroyed.
I'm going to stop you there, because in the last 40 seconds, I want to put that closing point to Sahil Shah in London, if I may, and I do apologize, as usual, for interrupting you, Mohammed. Sahil Shah in London, is there a third-way solution here? I mean, why not, say, use back-channel communications to talk to the new, relatively new, Iranian envoy to the UN? He is, formally, a nuclear negotiator. He knows what all the cards on the table are.
Well, President Rouhani himself is a former chief negotiator, so I think that what we really need to do is try to figure out a way in the short term to stabilize what could turn out to be escalation in a number of flashpoints between the U.S. and Iran. But in the medium to long term, Europe, Russia, and China really need to get together and figure out how they can sustain the Iranian economy in some way. Iran has accepted that it's not going to get to any of the pre-second...
We can sustain the Iranian economy in some way which allows them to continue their proxy wars around the region?
Secondary sanctions levels, but really, you know, we're on a slippery slope on the nuclear side whilst climbing a escalation ladder on the military side, and the two together could be quite disastrous. So I don't see a third-way solution outside of the framework which was already agreed upon in the JCPOA. Unfortunately, the Iranians rightfully see what Trump is offering in terms of talks as not genuine, because in the same breath, they are also announcing sanctions. For example, very shortly before Japanese leader was in Tehran, they announced new sanctions on the petrochemical industry. So it's not seen as genuine, and therefore there isn't much of a third way out of the current crisis other than just we're trying to at best return to as much as we can of the JCPOA. And for Europeans, that may mean not saying things like it's essentially game over for Europeans if Iran starts to blur the lines, but to figure out how to ensure that those blurrings of the lines don't result in things that are unacceptable to the U.S. and will lead to conflict.
Okay, we have to leave our conversation there. Thank you so much to all our guests today on Inside Story. They were Mohammed Mirandi, Hilary Mann Leverett, and Sahil Shah. And thank you, too, for your company. You can see the show again anytime on the website.
There you have it. Inside Story on Al Jazeera. But the way a different part of the world looks at this issue, which I find, some of it's stunning, right? Down is now up, right? Down is now up. When the hell did that happen? So, but the thing that I've learned probably the most is this whole concept of how the Iranian military, not the Iranian military, how the Republican Guards operates almost like a fifth column, almost like National Socialism operated in Germany, right? The brown shirts. It was almost like this. They weren't part of the military structure of Germany, but they were a huge force in German life. And ultimately, they created the SS, right, based on it. So, so it's interesting. So I need to do more programming about Iran and understanding those issues about Iran better, because if those things are true, right, and that the Iranian government doesn't really, truth be told, control the Republican Guard, then, and that this issue is essentially going down two tracks. One is the nuclear negotiation and the effect of sanctions on the Iranian economy, and then outside of that is the Republican Guards essentially executing their own policy that somehow gets concocted. Somebody just sent me an email. Mac, search on who controls the IRGC. I don't have time to do this. There's a whole bunch of interesting stuff. I'll read you a few of the headlines. Who really controls Iran's economy? All right. Khamenei reshuffles IRGC as regime faces tough challenges. IRGC in context. Iran's security and political landscape. Now, that sounds interesting, right? So, anyway, that'll do it on a Tuesday. Treaties that aren't ratified, right? The United States violating them. I don't know that you can violate a treaty you haven't ratified. I don't think you can. Maybe you can violate the spirit in which you signed it with, but if you understand how we all, like Vladimir Putin, when he signs, that means Russia's all in. But they're never in on anything, so that doesn't mean shit, right? When President Xi signs, that means China's all in, except they're never in on anything. So it's a joke. Russia and China, they don't play by any of the rules. So to me, it's the United States and Western Europe. Western Europe consistently caught in the middle of American positions as they try to balance out the economics of each one of those. So it's kind of the way it falls. You have the American position, you have European position that's largely defined by the economics of what we're talking about. So, don't touch that dial. You're going to hear kind of a little bit of a deep dive about treaties and ratification and what the Constitution says. But, I mean, I find it interesting. You may not, but I did. I think if you'll open your heart, you'll learn something. Yeah. Open your heart as well as your ears. Iran has said that the diplomatic path is now closed. Ruh-roh, what does that mean? Well, it can't mean we're going to start shooting, because if we start shooting, they lose. Okay? So that's the way that one works. So it must mean something else. Thanks for listening. On Tuesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.